There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hello, I'm David Marley, and welcome to the Independent's Coronavirus Podcast. This series is about getting behind the headlines and examining the issues affecting our lives as we navigate our way through the COVID-19 pandemic. Today, we are talking about alcohol. After months of being locked away in our homes, the pubs will reopen this weekend, prompting both celebration from people looking forward to a pint and a taste of normal life, but also concern from police that things could spiral out of control. As bars open again, now seems a good time to ask what 3 months of lockdown has done to our relationship with booze. Has being cooped up led us to drink more? Have we developed new habits that will be hard to shift? And is relying on a drink to help us cope with the anxieties of coronavirus really a problem? Today, I'm delighted to be talking to Ian Hamilton, Associate Professor of Addiction at the University of York and a regular columnist at The Independent, writing about alcohol and drugs policy and their impact. Hi, Ian. Thank you very much for being here. Do you think you can start by telling us about what we know about what has happened to our drinking patterns since coronavirus struck?
Well, we're getting more and more of an insight into what we've all been doing with alcohol as each week goes by. And probably the most interesting data that's come out is looking at retail sales. Because what that does is that gives us a comparison that we can make, you know, between how much alcohol is sold during COVID and the same period last year. And essentially what that shows is that we are buying more alcohol. So retail sales have gone up. Now, to some extent, you would expect retail sales to go up because, of course, as you said in your intro, pubs have been closed for a while. So you would expect more people to be buying what's known as off-license alcohol, you know, from supermarkets, off-licenses or online. But it seems the amount that we've been buying, outstrips what we would have consumed in restaurants or pubs. So we've definitely, as a group, as a population in the UK, been drinking more.
And do we know that that happened straight away? As soon as we went into lockdown, people, when they were stockpiling toilet paper and everything else, was booze part of that shopping list?
Yeah, it seems to have been part of the shopping list, you know, along with the pasta and toilet roll. So people clearly were cleverer than I was in anticipating any of those, needing any of those, because I certainly didn't stockpile alcohol. And no one I knew did either. So it was quite interesting to see that. And that was very early on. So that was, data that came out at the end of March, beginning of April, which, of course, was only a couple of weeks into lockdown. And straight away there was a spike. I mean, bizarrely, I don't think we should read anything into it, but bizarrely, rum sales were up 70%. I'm not quite sure why people gravitated towards rum, but more seriously, all sales of beer, spirits, wine were up generally.
And what do we know about who's buying it? Do we know whether it's people who were social drinkers who were drinking more, or is it people who already had an issue with alcohol who were kind of turning to it in an increasing way?
Well, we can't be 100% sure. So again, what we've got to rely on is kind of proxy data. So a couple of organisations, Alcohol Change UK and another organisation, really the Portman Group, which works on behalf of the alcohol industry, have done surveys of people. So these are samples of roughly about 2,000 people, the same as you would find in a political survey that we see in the news. And both those surveys have found the same thing. So I would tend to view them as reasonably representative of what's happened. And that is, we have two very distinct groups when it comes to drinking. The vast majority, so something like three quarters of people in these surveys, say that they're drinking about the same, less, or are abstaining since COVID began. But then we have another smaller group who were already drinking quite a bit before COVID and have actually increased their drinking since, you know, lockdown and the virus has spread through the population. So yeah, two very clear groups. One who I think probably had the drinking under control prior to COVID and have continued to drink at very low levels. And the other group who are more of a concern, who are drinking at very hazardous levels, i.e. 30 units of alcohol plus a week. Bearing in mind the government advice is 14 units a week. So they were drinking at least double what the government advises a week. And they've added to that during COVID.
And I'm sure everyone is closely monitoring their unit intake. But just to remind people, what constitutes a unit?
Yeah, no, it's a good thing to remind people about, because it's such an abstract term and we know that people get confused by it. So a unit is a small glass of wine with a kind of alcohol by volume, ABV, of about 11 or 12%. And when I say a small glass of wine, I mean 125 millilitres. So not the big glasses that you sometimes get served in pubs and restaurants, or half a pint of reasonably strong beer. So that's kind of what a unit would be.
So 30 units being then 15 pints a week, which, yeah, if you're going to the pub a couple of times a week, seems like, you know, two quite heavy nights in the pub if you're having 7 or 8 pints twice a week. But yeah, if you're at home kind of drinking kind of more steadily on a daily basis, it would be actually quite easy to get to that kind of, relatively easy to get to that kind of dangerous level.
It would. And sorry, just to go back to your point about, you know, drinking that 2 days a week, of course, that's not the government advice. The government advice is that that should be spread out over 5 days in every 7 day week. So you should have 2 days abstinent or dry, and those 15 units should be spread out over 5 days rather than stored up for the weekend and then, you know, consume them all in a day or two. So that's the other fact or a bit of advice with alcohol. But in terms of home drinking, yeah, you're absolutely right. One of the perhaps advantages there might be to pubs and restaurants opening up is that, of course, we don't pour our own measures when we're in the pub and restaurant, whereas when we're at home, we pour our own measures. And whether we deliberately pour larger measures or it's just more difficult to kind of discern how much or assess how much you're pouring into a glass, whether it's wine or a spirit, I'm not sure. I guess some people will know they're having a larger measure, but others just won't know. You know, we don't sit there with you know, our small measures of gin and pour them into a glass. We just kind of pour straight out the bottle. A bit similar to sometimes when you go to Europe, you know, on holiday, and they don't use measures as such. They just pour a spirit into a glass. So we know that people drink more when they're at home.
So we know that for the majority of people, do you say three quarters of people,
yeah,
not drinking more, but that still, yeah, leaves a big proportion of the drinking population who perhaps, you know, wouldn't consider themselves to necessarily, you know, be an alcoholic or have a kind of serious dependency issue, but drinking kind of more heavily, quite a large proportion of people. And they've been drinking more heavily over the past kind of few months. Do we know any of the reasons why they're turning to alcohol?
Well, I think it probably follows the same reason anyone would drink a little bit more prior to COVID, and that is we know there are a lot of people who, as you say rightly, don't view themselves as alcoholic, even though they may have developed a physical and psychological dependence on alcohol. But that dependence, you know, is very slow to happen. It's not like cocaine or heroin. You know, alcohol dependence takes years to develop. It doesn't happen in a short period of time. And we think what lies behind some of the dependence building up is trying to mitigate feelings of anxiety or other mental health issues such as depression, which are untreated. So COVID, of course, you know, provides that stimulus of anxiety, whether it's anxiety about the virus or about the economics, the problems people will be facing with the finances, with future employment, perhaps with relationships as well, being cooped up with people, losing your routine. All of these play in, not for everyone, but for some people, can make them that bit more anxious. And of course, alcohol mitigates in the short term feelings of anxiety and depression very well. It's very good at doing that. It makes you feel better. But as I say, unfortunately, that's at the price of then, entering a cause and effect type relationship where you feel anxious, you drink, you don't feel so good the next day, and you might carry on drinking, etc., etc. So it becomes a bit of a vicious circle, particularly if you have a clinical problem. We all feel from time to time a bit stressed or a bit fed up, but we're not clinically depressed or anxious. But if you have the symptoms of clinical anxiety and depression, it's clearly better to have that treated than to be trying to treat it yourself with a chemical like alcohol.
And you mentioned, perhaps anxiety over money or jobs or those kinds of issues. Obviously, there's been a lot of people furloughed and otherwise economically. But is there a kind of social divide in who's turning to drink more at this time?
I think there is. Class information on class and drugs generally, including alcohol, is quite hard to get hold of. We know more about the poorer people in society because they're more visible than we do the richer ones. One of the benefits of being rich is you can be quite hidden and anonymous in society if you choose to be, and most do. So what I mean by that is, obviously public treatment systems through the NHS do provide some support and care for people who develop problems with alcohol, and we can count the number of people who enter those services. But it's very difficult because it's hidden and it's guarded by private companies, those that offer high-end alcohol treatment, because they view their clients as regarding confidentiality as being really important. So they don't disclose how many people they treat, who they're treating, even basic demographics like age and gender. So I think alcohol does. Alcohol is like cocaine. Both drugs seem to affect every strata of society in terms of people developing problems with dependency. The difference is how you deal with that, and the jargon for it is, are you a functional alcoholic or are you dysfunctional? So functional just means, can you carry on doing the jobs that you and I are doing while having a drinking problem? And the chances are we probably could for some time before things might get out of hand. If I stopped turning up for work, I was smelling of alcohol. But of course, working remotely like this, I can't tell if you've had a drink, David, and you can't tell if I've had a drink. The only thing I could judge it by is whether I thought your speech was a bit slurred or whatever. So it may seem a trivial example, but I think people can mask and hide a problem with alcohol far more easily if you have money and you have resources than if you're skinned and don't have resources.
I think the working from home aspect of that is fascinating, because obviously we're aware that the pubs aren't open and perhaps people are drinking at home or whatever, but the way in which you can mask that, as you say, is very interesting. You said that it takes a while, it can take some time to develop dependency on alcohol. So if we're coming out of lockdown and this kind of journey kind of continues, if we don't get locked down again, what will the longer term impact of these trends of increased drinking among this group be? Have they had enough time to develop new bad habits and patterns of behaviour that will stay with them, or do you think that they go away when lockdown goes away?
Yes, it's a good point. So it's worth tipping it around the other way, because the best example we've got of this is campaigns like Dry January that many people will be familiar with. And of course, that's for a month. So that it's partly led by the science. There's good evidence to show that if you can change a habit, i.e. drinking, even in small amounts, even if you only drink within the government guidelines of 14 units a week, if you can stop doing that for a month, there's a good chance you can continue that behaviour. So given that COVID has been going, over 3 months now, or we've certainly been in lockdown for a good 3 months.
Yeah.
If people have upped their drinking for 3 months, I would suggest that's something that perhaps is going to be a lot trickier to get back under control or for them to address than if it had only lasted a month or even, you know, a shorter period. So I think we already had problems in this country with alcohol prior to COVID. You know, it's the best kept secret, really, in terms of admissions to hospital for alcohol-related problems. You know, we lead Europe in our health problems with alcohol, unfortunately. And in part, that's, we'll probably come on to this in a minute, that's partly through policy, partly through pricing and a range of other things. But yeah, we didn't start in a good place prior to this, David, in terms of the number of people who had a problem. And I think, unfortunately, we're only going to see that amplified with COVID. And that will play out over the next, you know, 5-10 years, I suspect.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
And obviously, there have been cuts to various kind of addiction services and public health services, so that will all play into that becoming a bigger problem over time, I presume.
It will. I mean, I have mixed views about this. I think, you know, it's all too easy to say we need more resources for addiction treatment and alcohol in particular. And of course, I think, you know, that would be very welcome. But I think there's a lot of services and support charities and others could do to kind of really reform the way that they work. At the moment in this country, we seem to have this philosophy within drug and alcohol treatment that what happens is we wait until people say they need help or they hit rock bottom, would be the expression, before we intervene. Now, we don't do that with cancer. We don't do that with diabetes. We don't do it with a range of other problems like cardiac disease and so on. But somehow we seem to think that it's okay to do that with drug and alcohol problems. What I'd prefer to see is that the best parallel is with mental health. Over the last two decades, mental health treatment has changed radically. So when I became a mental health nurse nearly 30 years ago, we relied on people coming to appointments, a bit like drug and alcohol treatment do now. And what's changed is mental health treatment has reformed itself, and now we offer things like assertive outreach. So we go and find people who we know are in the early stages of developing serious problems like schizophrenia, bipolar depression, etc. And I think we should do the same for alcohol and drug use. We should be intervening far earlier than waiting for people to get to the lowest point in their life when, you know, the problems they have with alcohol or with drugs has ravaged them, ravaged their families, and often the communities they live in as well.
So we're touching on government policy there about how those problems are addressed. Obviously the government has had a lot on its hands over the last few months dealing with the pandemic, but they haven't really said anything much of there have been few words of caution about alcohol during that period, but a lot of clamour to get the pubs back open, even before there's a kind of concrete plan to get schools open for all children. What kind of messaging have they been giving, and is that also problematic?
Well, I think alcohol policy is a bit like tobacco smoke. Tobacco policy was a few years ago. You know, it was politicians of any colour were reluctant to really do what they knew they had to do with tobacco. You know, I think the evidence around the harm that tobacco was causing in the population had been clear for decades before. It was Tony Blair in the Labour government who, you know, took the really courageous decision to ban it in public places. And that was probably made one of the most significant impacts on public health we've seen in two or three decades. So, but in alcohol, we're at the same stage where I think politicians, again, of any colour, I'm not being party political about this, I think a Labour government as well as a Conservative one, feel very nervous about interfering with the tradition we have in this country of consuming alcohol. And it became apparent really right from the beginning of COVID what the approach was going to be. Even before lockdown, it was made clear that off licences would be put in the same category as pharmacies. They'd be deemed essential services.
It was incredible, wasn't it, when that happened? Because they were off the list to begin with. And then after an outcry, then they very quickly found themselves back on the list.
They did. And, you know, some of that would have been down to, I think, lobbying by the industry. And fair enough, you know, that's what they employ those lobbyists to do, in the same way we have lobbyists in the fishing industry or, you know, advocating at the moment for airlines. So they're just doing their job. But I think they were pushing on a fairly open door with that one. You know, I think we do have a government that's fairly libertarian in its approach, and I understand that. But I think you can be libertarian and offer, you know, the advice and the science. You know, I think the government's been very keen when it comes to the pandemic to, you know, push the science out in front and say how they're going to follow it. But on the same token, have said absolutely nothing about alcohol. And if people have been using alcohol to cope with COVID, then that deserves a little bit of a mention, I think, and just to remind people of some of the hazards. Not for everyone. The vast majority of people, I think I probably should have said this at the beginning, David, but the vast majority of people won't develop a problem with alcohol. They'll enjoy the odd drink and it'll enhance their lives. It won't cause them any problems. But there is a rump. There is a small proportion in the population who undoubtedly do have a problem and they need intervention, they need support. And unfortunately, the alcohol industry has been so effective in lobbying for their own cause that public health on this doesn't really get an input.
And is it right that some countries have taken a much more, during coronavirus, have taken a much more proactive stance? I think you mentioned to me before that South Africa has actually banned alcohol sales. Is that right?
It has. You know, they've been very assertive. I think it's caused its own problems, and it just shows how no public health measure is problem-free. So, of course, the obvious thing when you start banning alcohol in a country, particularly one like South Africa, or, you know, indeed it could be a country in Europe, I just mean the size of South Africa, is that you open up all sorts of possibilities for the black market. So that creates its own dangers. So you think that you solved one problem as a government by trying to remove alcohol from the population. And the main reason they did that wasn't to protect individual health. It was to reduce the pressure on hospitals and accident and emergency. So again, interesting that if we think back to the beginning of COVID in the UK and the push there was, you know, you think of things like the Nightingale Hospital, you know, the drafting in of staff, would that not have been an ideal time to have talked about alcohol? I don't mean ban alcohol, just talked about alcohol to try and reduce the pressure on our NHS at that time. But none of that was mentioned. So I think we have a government who's got the ear of, or rather an industry that's got the ear of the government. Alcohol has, relative to income, never been cheaper than it's ever been. And it's more widely available. You can get alcohol, you know, bizarrely. You're not allowed to drink and drive, but you can drive into a petrol station and buy wine.
Yeah. If we look at what the comparison between what's happened to alcohol during coronavirus and the legal drug market, what comparison can you draw there? Have people also increased their use of illegal drugs?
Well, it almost fits with what we're saying with South Africa and the black market, which of course then becomes the illicit market in alcohol. The illicit drug market, as each month has gone on, has proved itself to be more resilient than our legitimate economy. Internationally, what's happened is we've seen some very clever initiatives go on. So in the past, when I say in the past, I mean prior to COVID, it's not that far in the past, is it? But last year, what we would see is a large number of small, if you like, packages of drugs being moved around via airlines mainly, people, drug mules or whatever. Occasionally with, ships, the speedboats, all the kind of James Bond type style stuff going on. But in the main, it was through air travel. That's become obviously riskier and also impossible in certain weeks as air travel has been closed down. Mm-hmm. So what the cartels have done is moved fewer consignments of drugs, but in far bigger quantities. So they've upped the risk of moving drugs around. What that's meant is we've seen seizures in Europe, South America, and America go up. But we think seizures have only gone up in proportion to the amount of drugs that have successfully got through. So on the supply side, there's been no problems on the supply side. What we have seen is some speculative, and certainly in the UK and certain parts of the UK, speculative price increases, which don't seem to be based on supply problems. It is just people kind of being opportunistic, small-time dealers being opportunistic in raising prices of drugs like heroin and cocaine. So if you do use drugs, you'll know that actually your supply has been uninterrupted. Prices have been pretty stable. There has been some shifts in drug use. So people have moved away, unsurprisingly, from party drugs like MDMA or ecstasy to, so they've moved away really from stimulants like MDMA or amphetamine, to sedative drugs like cannabis and benzodiazepines, so diazepam in particular.
And as we look towards the weekend, how do you feel? Are you kind of filled with a slight sense of foreboding, or do you think that if it could be managed correctly, reopening the pubs will actually be a positive way of kind of regulating people's alcohol intake, perhaps not on this Saturday?
No, exactly. That would be the message to give, David, wouldn't it? Don't have all your units this Saturday. But I think in the main, it's going to be something that's good. You know, it's, as we know, the pub isn't just about consuming alcohol. It's that sense of community, belonging. And when people have been isolated for so long, it doesn't fill me with any great anxiety. I think, as I said earlier on, I think what people might do is actually potentially drink a little less, you know, because they can only buy measured spirits or beers, or they're not pouring their own when they go to the pub or to a restaurant. So in that sense, it can only be good. But of course, in the background, we won't have removed the problems we went into COVID with, or that have actually been amplified as far as alcohol's concerned for that smaller proportion of the population. And I suppose I'm not anxious about pubs opening. I am anxious about the wider economy and the effect that's going to have on our public services, including alcohol treatment and support as well.
Ian, thank you for that. That's absolutely fascinating. Thank you for joining us. Thank you for listening. If you're a new listener, please subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Acast, or wherever you listen. If you have suggestions for things you'd like us to discuss, please get in touch on email at the coronavirus podcast@independent.co.uk, or you can use the hashtag #IndieCoronavirusPodcast, INDY coronavirus podcast, and we'll see your post. You can read about all the unfolding news to do with COVID-19 on our website, independent.co.uk, and in our downloadable daily edition app. And there's also an email newsletter you can sign up to if you want the latest news and developments delivered to your inbox. Thank you so much again for listening, and please join us again next time.
Hold up. Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.